Thank you. It's my privilege to announce commitment to CGI. Let me invite to the stage Mark Shelley, founder and executive director, C Studios Foundation, and Edward Norton. The commitment of C Studios Foundation is to creating large-scale awareness in the United States of the interconnections amongst the challenges of climate change, poverty, health, and natural resource degradation through an integrated media initiative. The value of this commitment is $16 million over 2 years. As is commitment, C Studios Foundation will produce a major integrated media initiative that helps audience understand the connections between seemingly different problems and solutions in global health, poverty, climate change, and the environment. Strange Days on Planet Earth 2020 will harness the power of television, internet, and new media with a goal of reaching 20 million new viewers and engaging a total of 50 million internet users. It will also include periodic personal events featuring Academy Award winner, rather Academy Award nominee. Well, I was trying to predict the future, not describe the past. Edward Norton. Live screenings will help to build momentum for sustainable solutions by involving business leaders, policymakers, and civil society. Congratulations, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. William Drayton, CEO and Chair, Ashoka, Innovators for the Public. His Excellency, Mohammed Al Girgawi, Minister of State for Cabinet Affairs, United Arab Emirates, Chairman, Dubai Holding. Robert E. Rubin, Chairman of the Executive Committee, Citigroup Incorporated. Mohammed Yunus, Founder and Managing Director, Grameen Bank. And our moderator, Daljeet Dhaliwal, Anchor, PBS.
Good morning, everybody. I hope you can hear me. And welcome, and thank you very much for turning up this morning. It's great to see so many people here. I'm sure it was the idea of speaking to our distinguished panelists and a great breakfast, of course, that brought you out here this morning. So thank you very much. Before we hear from our distinguished panelists, I'd like to thank the Clinton Global Initiative for bringing together this very impressive panel, and also for inviting me to moderate our discussion on how social entrepreneurs are shaking things up and how they're redefining how we approach development, whether it's in the area of poverty, climate change, education, or healthcare. And of course, those are all CGI focus areas for 2007. Now, each of our panelists have produced high impact results in their own unique way. So what we want to do this morning is to share some of those success stories with our audience and talk about how they are approaching some of the world's most intractable problems with innovative and exciting solutions. So let me tell you a little bit more about the panelists that we have with us. We have Mohammed Al Girgawi, welcome. He is the United Arab Emirates Minister of State for Cabinet Affairs and Chairman of Dubai Holding, which has 170 companies and over 34,000 workers in the area of finance, healthcare, real estate and industry. He's also chairman of the Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum Foundation, which has an endowment of $10 billion and seeks to bring about a knowledge-based society in the Arab and Muslim world through areas like education, youth empowerment and culture. Mr. Gagawi is also one of a handful of people who oversaw Dubai's rapid expansion into a financial, tourism and travel capital, as well as that great accomplishment. He's also the founding chairman of the Young Arab Leaders, which is a pan-Arab NGO that focuses on youth as one way of improving the Arab and Muslim region. We also have with us Robert E. Rubin, who we've also already heard from this morning. And Robert is chairman and CEO of Citi. He has been involved with financial markets and America's public policy debate for much, if not all, of his professional life. And he joined the Clinton administration in 1993, holding a number of posts, including Secretary of the Treasury. He helped the administration manage the global financial crisis that had threatened to unravel the global economy. Mr. Rubin organized the largest financial bailouts in history, first to prevent the meltdown of the Mexican economy in 1994, and then to contain the Asian crisis that spread throughout Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, and South Korea. He is chairman of the Board of Local Initiative Support Corporation, which is the nation's leading community development support organization, and of course also wrote a book called An Uncertain World, Tough Choices from Wall Street to Washington. And also with us, sitting right next to me, is Professor Mohammed Yunus, who is a Nobel Peace Prize winner and has been described as a revolutionary. His passion has helped move millions of people out of poverty through his global movement of microcredit. His Grameen Bank is an example of how a profitable business can also provide real social benefit. Grameen lends to the very poorest, and it focuses, in fact, on women and asks no collateral of its borrowers. Today, more than 250 institutions in nearly 100 countries operate along the lines of Grameen's model, and I'm sure if I've got that figure right, you'll correct me later on. Now, in addition to receiving many other international awards, he's also won the Food Prize Award and the Mother Teresa Award. Professor Yunus has served on many, many international bodies, among them the United Nations International Advisory Group for the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing and the Global Commission of Women's Health. Last but not least, we have with us Bill Drayton, who popularized the term social entrepreneur. He's also President Clinton's pick, apparently, to become a winner of a Nobel Prize, I think. Is that correct? And as you all know, Bill is founder and CEO of Ashoka, Innovators for the Public. The organization has grown into a flourishing network of social entrepreneurs around the world who act as role models for furthering progress in areas of human need. He's also chair of Youth Venture, Community Greens, and Get America Working. Before founding Ashoka, Bill worked at McKinsey & Company in New York, and between 1977 and 1991, he was the assistant administrator at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, where he had the lead responsibility for making sure that environmental issues were indeed reflected in the administration's policy-wide development. So let's give them all a big round of applause for being here. Bill, let me start with you. I mean, what in your view makes a good social entrepreneur, and why do you think that we need them?
What makes a great entrepreneur? I think it's the same business and social. You have to have four qualities, I think. One, an idea that you're married to that's going to change the pattern in the world. And you're committed to changing the whole society, not a local effect. That means that you're very realistic, open, constantly iterative change until you get to where you're going. Creativity, ethical fiber, very, very important. I think when thinking about entrepreneurs, we think about the impact they have directly. Muhammad Yunus, of course, has built microcredit and figured out how to make that work. But he's also spread it across the world. His vision was global from the beginning. Now, think about what the implications of that are. We have to get, I believe, to an everyone a change maker world. The small elites that have run everything for 12,000 years, just it doesn't work anymore. If you think the problems are outrunning the solutions, of course they are. Now, how do we make the jump from small elites to empowering everyone? Well, every social entrepreneur is doing their direct work, microcredit in Eunice's case, but they're also, as you said, a role model. People say, if Eunice can do this, well, I could do something. Beyond that, the entrepreneur is a mass recruiter of local change makers. This is less understood, but it's very much at the core of how we get to everyone a change maker world. We don't try to capture a market. Our job is to change the world, and therefore you have to have your idea be as simple and usable, as safe, understandable, supported where necessary as possible, because your purpose is to get local people in community after community after community to stand up and say, yeah, that's a pretty good idea. I can do that. That's how we succeed, by empowering local people to stand up and be change makers. And they in turn become role models, and some of them move on to the next level and become the next generation of entrepreneurs. People don't resist this. They love being powerful. Everyone in this room has that experience. And I think our most important impact is actually at this moment in history, as important as the direct impacts are, the bigger impact is helping us get to everyone a change maker.
That's a lot of stuff that I want to come back to, the idea of change makers, a little later on in our discussion. But let me bring you, Mr. Gagawi, into the conversation. The Gulf region and the Middle East as a whole is, of course, critical to global security and also to prosperity. Talk about the key challenges that you think the region faces, and also how governments and how civil society and also businesses are trying to address those challenges.
I think the problem that we have in the Middle East, there is three challenges, the way I look at it. One, geopolitical challenges. Political stability is one of the issues that we have. And if you look at the map 10 years ago and today, it's much more complex than it used to be. Back then, we had only one issue, is the Palestinian-Israeli issue. Today, we have Iraq, we have Afghanistan, and we have so many issues within our region. Second challenge that we have, it is more of an economic challenge. Growth rate been very low in our region. It's if you look at the growth rate, basically it's close to 1.5 compared to Asia of 4% in the past one decade. If you look at difficulty in doing business within our region, bureaucracy is quite high, corruption in certain countries is quite high. The third element, which is very important for us and for the world, is youth. We need to create 80 million jobs in the next 10 years. No other region in the world, no other economy in the world provided 80 million jobs in that span of time.
Is that just in the Gulf region, or
no,
are you talking
about
the Middle East?
No, that's the whole Middle East and North Africa. So either we have, in the next 10 years, 80 million young, productive young people in the Middle East, or we have 80 million radical extremists in the Middle East. So the challenge is there. What we need to do, basically, we need to tackle this issue. There's a lot of talk about it. We need to focus. There is a lot of solution, but I believe that whatever we want to do, it wouldn't impact only our region. Whatever we are doing right now is we are focusing our region and looking at the world in its totality, basically. What is our impact? 80 million, you're going to look at 80 million young as an opportunity or a threat. Our job through whatever we are trying to do is to create an opportunity for us, for our region, if we have 80 million talent young people, but also for the world security.
Well, there's certainly a lot of challenges there, and I know that you are chairman of a foundation, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit about what that foundation is doing to bring about change, especially when it comes to engaging youth in terms of culture and youth empowerment. But let me also turn to you, Bob. I mean, from your vast experience in government and in the financial world, what do you think are the best ways to bring about socially responsible economic development, whether it's in the area of direct foreign investment or aid and indeed microfinancing?
Let me ask you a question, if I may, then I'll respond. When you say socially responsible, you mean what?
Well, socially... socially responsible in the sense that... business is usually sort of credited with bringing about change in its field, but there are also a group of social entrepreneurs who are driving change from the bottom upwards, and they have an ethic, if you like, or an ethos that they want to bring to that change. And I was just wondering whether something like that exists in the realm of business and whether it marries up with government and whether you have any experiences of coming across that in the financial world or in the business world.
Actually, we have a very good model in the United States, which you mentioned in my introduction. And I have thought to myself that it may well be applicable in the developing world, but then I want to make one other comment after that. And that is we have, across the United States, about 3,500 community development corporations, which are neighborhood-led. They're located in inner cities and distressed rural areas. And then there are these overriding or overarching, if you will, community development organizations. You mentioned local initial support corporation. I have the chair, which is one of them. And LIS, that's what it's called, intermediates between the providers of capital, the large banks, insurance companies, what have you, who don't know how to navigate in the inner cities, and then the inner cities, which have neighborhood leadership. And it has occurred to me that there might be some, I really hadn't thought about it until I was thinking about this panel, but there might be some kind, there might be some way to create analogous kinds of institutions for developing countries in which you drew on the local leadership, because they know best what social entrepreneurs you're talking about, what best to do, and the vast pools of capital that developed over the last 10 years in the hands of private equity funds, hedge funds, sovereign wealth funds, and all these kinds of institutions that are energetically looking for new places to invest but don't know how to navigate in many of these developing countries. I think there actually is a germ of an idea there that would take a little work to develop it. But more broadly, I'll give you one sentence comment. I think the key to moving large numbers of people out of poverty, well, I think all these things are extremely important, but I think the key to moving large numbers of people out of poverty still remains sound and effective economic policy, and that requires effective governments that are willing to make and are able to make the politically and substantively very, very difficult decisions that relate to having a broad-based and sound economic policy regime.
And I guess that requires good governance.
What do you mean by good governance? Well, no.
I get to ask the questions on this panel.
Yeah, questions only have meaning if we know what the words mean. Good governance.
Well, what's your definition of good governance?
Well, good governance is often meant to mean a non-corrupt government. I think it's a very complicated question. I think corruption is an enormous impediment to economic growth. On the other hand, you look at some of the great success stories of post-World War II globe in terms of bringing people out of poverty, and they occurred in countries with a lot of corruption. So while I think corruption is a terrible detriment in many ways to economic growth, some of the most successful the Chinese leadership openly discusses the problems of pervasive corruption in China. And yet China is the single greatest success story in the last 25 years. So it's a very complicated question. Corruption has undermined growth across a whole array of countries. Sub-Saharan Africa probably is the best example of that. And on the other hand, there are very successful countries that have corruption, and one needs to understand what the distinctions are in those situations, in my opinion.
Mohamed Yunus, you've been described as a revolutionary, and you were applauded for that by our audience. Talk about how many of the world's poor you think have benefited from microfinancing.
Well, the last count is about 125 million borrowers of microfinance globally. We set up a goal back in 1997 to reach 100 million poorest families with microcredit, preferably to the women in those families, by 2005. And then 2005 was declared as the International Year of Microcredit. So we celebrated that in 2005, and we reached that 100 million next year, 2006. So now today it's 125 million. But this is a good achievement, but at the same time you have to see how many people in the world are not reaching out, are not being reached out with microcredit today. So we have to expand that to reach out. Out of that 125 million, interesting figure is 85% are in Asia, 10% is in Africa, 5% is Latin America. So it's a very thinly done in many parts of the world, so we need to expand that. Out of the 85% in Asia, 50% of that, of the total, 50% out of 85% is in between Bangladesh and India.
And why did you, I mean, you focus obviously on the world's poorest, but you do target and highlight women. Well, why did you feel that it was important to give credit to women and not ask for any collateral?
It came as a kind of protest against the conventional banks that I saw around me. Back when I was starting this in one village, I was complaining not only banks reject poor people from their services, they also reject women. And I challenged them, at least, can you show me that even 1% of your borrowers happen to be women? They couldn't. There isn't 1% of the borrowers in Bangladesh as women. So I said, when I began, I wanted to make sure half the borrowers in my program are women. I thought that would be the just thing to do. And when I went to the women said, no, don't give it to me. I don't know anything about money. Give it to my husband. He's the one who handles money. So it was a very tough thing for me.
And these are also traditional patriarchal societies.
Absolutely.
So you kind of
did very male-dominated societies, particularly in the villages, where women stayed home. Man is the one breadwinner of the family, so he's the one going out. Many women even explain, I never touched money in my life. I don't want to get involved with that. It's a scary thing for me. So it was a hard thing. It took us 6 years to reach that level, 50-50. Then we noticed that money that went to the family through women brought much more benefit to the family than the money, even the same amount of money going to the family through men. So we've seen a whole list of things changing, like if the woman is the borrower, children became the immediate beneficiary of mother's income. But you don't see that happening when the father is the income earner. Women had accumulated a wonderful experience, a wonderful skill of managing scarce resources, because husband always gave her a little, whatever he could earn.
Are you saying that the men squander the money?
Well, you can extend. now you are getting me into trouble. all I'm saying, women are better. So we changed our mind. I said, well, what is so good about 50-50? Let's concentrate on women. So we started concentrating on women. So today, we have within Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, 7.5 million borrowers. 97% of them are women. And all the wonderful things that happened to Bangladesh and to Grameen Bank is because of our policy that we concentrated on women. All the things, you see the impact on the children. One of the things that we achieved, all the children of Grameen families were in school. These are all illiterate families, totally illiterate. Father doesn't know how to read and write, mother doesn't know how to read. Never literacy entered those families. But within that families, through Grameen Bank, we ensured that 100% of the children are in school. Today, many of them are in higher education, in medical schools, engineering schools. Right now, We have over 18,000 students in medical schools and engineering schools in higher education and universities. And entire financing is done by Grameen Bank through education loans. So we are trying to create a whole new generation out of those poor women that joined Grameen Bank. So we said the poverty cycle should not be repeated. This should be broken. So if a new generation come out, they'll be completely different than their parents. So this is one that we saw the impact comes in the family through all these concentrated efforts and bringing information technology into those families. So we, early on, we became very interested in the information technology. We created Grameen Phone, a cell phone company. We started bringing cell phone in the rural areas and giving loans to the women to buy the cell phone and start the selling the service of the cell phone and make money out of it. That became successful. Then we started something called social business, the idea that you've been talking here. It's business to do good to people exclusively rather than making any money out of it. So this is another kind of business rather than philanthropy. We thought this dollar, the social business dollar, will be much more powerful dollar than the philanthropy dollar. Because in philanthropy dollar, you can have one use of the dollar. But in a social business dollar, it recycles and reaches out money more. So we have created those social business, combined it with Danone in France. It's a Grameen Danone company. And recently, we just had a meeting here in the Clinton Global Initiative with the chairman of Intel. So we're having Intel Grameen program to bring as a social business. They will not take any profit out of it. And Grameen will not take any profit out of it, to concentrate to bring information technology to the poorest people so that they can change their own life. They have all the creativity in the world. Simply, facilities are not being available to them. Mm-hmm. So we are trying to create that.
Well, maybe one day there'll be some time will arrive when microfinancing may not be needed. But, well...
microfinancing may not be needed, but the financing will be needed anyhow, because human beings, to pursue their economic goals, they need financing, whether it's financing for education, whether it's financing for health, whether it's financing for business, financing for housing. So today's financial system is a half-done system. It doesn't reach out to more than half the population of the world. Mm-hmm. So we said financial system should be an inclusive system. Nobody should be excluded from that system. And I even say that credit should be accepted as a human right, so that we design a system where nobody can be excluded from that system. So that will be needed anyhow.
Right. Bill, let me bring you into the conversation. Is there anything that Mohammed says that resonates with your experiences of being a social entrepreneur and in motivating the role models that you seek out as part of your organization with Ashoka?
Very much. I think it might be helpful if we work together on a problem, and I think it'll illustrate a number of the themes that we've been coming at here. Think about small farmers. If they can get drip irrigation, you can double or triple the output. It's more secure. You're saving water. But small farmers don't get drip irrigation because it's not profitable for the companies to reach down to these smaller areas. In Mexico, the cutoff is somewhere between 10 and 55 hectares, depending on whether the land is flat or hilly. The government has proven incapable of solving this problem pretty much across the world. And so big farmers get drip irrigation and small farmers don't. Now, how do we solve this problem? There's a change in the world that makes this possible now. Around 1980, the citizen half of the world became entrepreneurial and competitive in the same sense as business. Anyone can enter with a better idea, and if you implement, you'll gain market share and resources, etc. As a result, we've had a quarter of a century of extremely rapid catch-up with business. So you now have the two halves of the world's operations with the same architecture and the productivity gap being closed. So just let me take the case of Mexico. Now you have, which were not there 10 years ago, large citizen groups created by social entrepreneurs by and large, serving 50,000, 200,000 small farmers. And they have what the companies that can't serve this market have, they have some advantages. Their cost structure is much lower. They want to serve the small farmers. There's trust both ways. They understand how to deal with this environment. Now, on the other hand, they're pretty terrible at making plastic or metal pipes. What we have now is a possibility of changing a system that is on the face of it crazy, where every human need has been served by a business system and a social system that haven't talked to one another. Now the two systems, A, can talk to one another, and they're getting close enough in terms of productivity that you can put them together. So we have been, in fact, working on this in a number of industries, and Eunice's example with Danone is another good example of this principle. So we went to the biggest piping company in Latin America and said, how would you like to get into this market? And they wondered why we weren't McKinsey, but once they got over that, it started talking to us. And we had to go to many citizen groups to get a few to be willing to take the risk of working with business and losing money for the first 4 to 6 months. Now, the result is that, in fact, this is now working. We're down to 1 hectare. We have sales growing very, very rapidly. We've created a joint venture between business and society that is going to change the economics of our farmers. Think how many hundreds of millions of small farmers around the world could get drip irrigation because you put together this new business system. The same principle applies food production, the Danone Grameen example, or building slum housing. In our experience in Mexico with that system, you cut from 5 years to 9 months to add a room, 30% less cost. Well, now everyone wins here. The company gets a new market. The citizen group gets the 30 to 50% markup. They help their clients. They have a competitive advantage to begin with. Their competitors can't do this for a while. And, of course, the ultimate consumer wins. Now, most of our panel has a finance background. Of course, we have a financing problem. If you have 100 million farmers who need drip irrigation and it costs $5,000 a hectare, there's a new financing need here. We have to build a retail finance structure, and then we can work through the major banks. Who wouldn't want to get an 8% return to help farmers double or triple their income? So I just wanted to give you a sense that we are at a really major historical transformation point, that we need to change the systems overall. And when you come to changing the systems, what do you need? You need entrepreneurs who break all the existing boundaries, specifically including the boundary between business and society.
Thank you. Mr. Gagawi, I mean, I want to bring you into the conversation as well. You are chairman of a foundation that is working in your region, and you believe that it's important to engage youth and to empower youth for some of the challenges that you talked about a little earlier on. Why do you think that it's very, very important to sort of bring youth into the equation? What is it about that part of the world that makes it such a pressing problem?
Politically, you understand our region basically quite well and the impact on our security. For us, we started the journey a couple of years ago, actually. Myself and a couple of colleagues of mine, we started something called Young Arab Leader. A lot of people ask us why Young Arab Leader. We thought that we lack within our region, really, role model. One of the issues that we have in the Middle East and the Arab world, you don't have champion, basically, for the youngster to look up to. We started 4 years ago. Today we have chapter almost every single Arab country. And the way we did it, we didn't do it with a government basically, we do it through entrepreneurship. We created seed fund, we created scholarship for younger students to go to education, to university. But the big picture, that's a small example basically of transforming our region. Somebody got to do it. We hear there is a lot of problems in the Middle East and the Arab world, but unfortunately, nobody's tackling this issue. Through our foundation, we want to really empower youth. We believe that if we empower youth, a tremendous transformation can take place. unfortunately, even the economic situation or even the economic vehicle within the Middle East doesn't help, doesn't create a good quality job. Our education system, if we look at youth, we have one of the highest growth in population in the world. It's 2.4 compared to 1.5 in India, for example. For us, if we transform our youth through education and through quality of education, one of the biggest projects that we are concentrated at, yes, we have flow of graduates from university. We need to create a good quality that the market can take and absorb. We are creating a program with various universities, basically, to enhance the quality and management standard in university. We cannot go. We have 18 million young people. We cannot impact each one of them. If we impact the education system, university education system, it means we'll have a better talent pool that will be absorbed through the market. And through our experience, if I look at myself, basically, and I look at my country as United Arab Emirates, we get our independence from England in 1971, very young country. We got back then only 45 graduates in the whole country, university graduates. Today, out of them, actually, five were women. Through education transformation, today we have our enrollment from high school to university is 92%, and that's female, 92%. So this is the highest. It is the highest in the world.
States, though, right?
That's in the United Arab Emirates, and 92% enrollment from high school to university, female. It is actually the highest in the world. So there is through education you can transform society. But I look at myself, my parents are illiterate. So nobody, it's good and bad. When I grow up, nobody asked me how well I did in my homework. but through an education system.
You actually studied in Michigan, didn't you?
Yes. Through education system, we came. I'm sitting here today, but if I look at my parents, probably they never thought that I'll be here today. So through education, basically, we can empower. There is 80 million people better than me, actually, in the region. But they need the opportunity, basically, to transform the region. And through our input, basically, we work very hard in our small country to transform the country, basically, where we went to a point where 92% of the enrollment in high school are female. And we are proud. This is much higher than the United States, by the way, and the highest in the world. So a lot of things can be done in the Middle East and the Arab world and the Muslim world for female, basically. But we need to focus, we need to concentrate on education, basically, and we've seen the change.
Well, you say a lot of things can be done. Can you give us some concrete examples of how the foundation has actually helped young people and has helped women in particular, for example, through the projects that you
We launched the foundation 4 months ago. So
we are
launching our project next month. But I'll give you... We are concentrating the foundation in knowledge. We understand that we need to concentrate in knowledge through three pillars, basically, that we are doing. I talked about the problem that we have. We are saying we'll be one of the foundation who's going to transform our region. One of the pillars is education. Education, we concentrated also in leadership education, mainly people who's going to impact a wider number in their society. And just we finalized with Harvard, with Yale, with Oxford, some fellowship program to create future leaders in various sectors of life. And through education, we're creating a quality standard for university within our region. We believe if we impact university, we'll impact the whole society, basically, there. Another important element that we are looking at, really, it is job creation. If we need 80 million jobs, we need to create jobs, basically. And we are working with the university of creating seed fund for senior students, basically, and various universities, basically, where they're going to start business. And the model that we are looking at, basically, sustainable model, exactly as Mr. Yunus said, they got to give back again for other students who are going to come after them. And this is our humble contribution. We cannot go and change the world. But I think and the third pillar I want to add is culture. To uplift our region, let's concentrate on culture. I'll give you an example. For each 100,000 books that's being published in the United States, 6,500 only being published in the Arab world. What we are doing, we are translating book from English to Arabic to create knowledge. We are creating endowment for young writer. We want also to lift the society through knowledge, basically, so we are really creating that for them. And it's a process of change at the end of the day. And for the first time, in January, we're creating the first forum for all the Arab world endowment fund, basically, to sit together. And I look at the United States, basically, as a whole, it became a phenomenon in the United States. And we had a couple of meetings while we were here, basically, to know from them, to learn. But we are one of the first people who created, really, endowment for knowledge in our region, basically. I don't think so we'll see a result tomorrow, but we'll see it in long term. Another example when it comes to women empowerment, for example. We have an e-college in Dubai. And we found out the majority of the students are female from our country who enrolled there. An idea like that, we are taking it through the whole of the Arab world. We want to give access of education to females. Some of them, they cannot go outside to other city, basically, to university. So we would like to go to
them. Rights are very limited in parts of the region. I mean, still in terms of voting and the freedom of travel and movement. So.
But the most important thing is there is no economic prosperity. We want to create that through really education at the end of the day. So going to them, it will transform the whole society as our society been transformed, basically. And I said, 30 years ago, almost, we had only 5 university graduates. Today, we have the highest enrollment for female in university in the world, actually. So you can create the right. If you empower people, if you believe in what you are doing, you know that this is the right thing to do for society, a tremendous change can take place. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Robert, I'd like to get your feedback just on what you've heard so far in terms of whether social entrepreneurs are necessary, or is it just something that governments should be looking after? Shouldn't they be curing society's ills as somebody who has been part of government?
I think you need to operate at both levels. Discussion with Mexico was interesting. That's a country I know a touch about. I think on the one hand, I think social entrepreneurism can be enormously important, and I think unfortunately in Mexico there's been far too little attention to exactly the kind of activity you're talking about. On the other hand, with it all, Mexico is growing at about 3.5% per annum or something like that, which is woefully insufficient if there's ever going to be real progress made in bringing the very large numbers of poor out of poverty. And fundamentally in Mexico, what you've had is you've had, I think it's the last 3 presidencies, and you know they have 6-year presidencies, that have done a fair bit in the way of reform. That notwithstanding, government has not been sufficiently effective in terms of putting in place policies oriented toward growth and toward broad-based sharing that growth to create the kind of growth that the Asian countries have had. And I think that the lesson of Latin America more generally is that when all is said and done, compare Latin America to Asia, when all is said and done, what is the big difference? The big difference is that in a goodly number of Asian countries, you've had government that has effectively pursued sound policies that promote growth and broad participation in growth, and the consequence is you have growth rates of 6, 7, 8, China's case 10%, and in Latin America there's only one country that's had Asian rates of growth. And I think all of this is extremely important, but I think fundamentally if you're going to get the kind of large movement of people out of poverty that one would hope to have, then I think I think absolutely essential to that is effective government. And one of the interesting questions for the industrial world is what, if anything, can be done in the industrial world to try to help promote effectiveness of government in developing countries? And that's a very hard question to which, in my judgment at least, nobody's found any very good answers.
Okay, can you give us some examples that you think are credible examples of the Asian countries that you're speaking about? What are some of the good models there?
Well, you might not like the politics of some of these countries, but the fact is that Singapore was a fishing village in the late 1940s. They put in place a remarkably effective economic policy agenda, and today they're a massively prosperous country. China, since the reform began in 1978, has brought hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. It grows at 9, 10, 10% a year. Taiwan, Hong Kong, Korea. You really go across Asia, and it's been remarkable. And I think one of the a group of us, myself, Larry Summers, been my deputy, a number of others, been Treasury, had a very interesting meeting about 4 years ago in Cambridge while Larry was at Harvard, well, he still is at Harvard, when he was president of Harvard, about what it is that is, and I think this is what people are interested in development economics. It is a central conundrum, which if you can understand it, I think could be enormously valuable. Why is it that almost across Asia, you've had these very high rates of growth, while sub-Saharan Africa has been a dismal failure? Even now, it's the average growth this year in sub-Saharan Africa is something like 6.5% or something like that, despite the massive upsurge in commodities prices that were an opportunity for a jump start that's not being taken advantage of. And basically, sub-Saharan Africa, you know, has had very low rates of growth over the last 30 years. And Latin America, which has had some very good reform-oriented political figures, and yet only one country in Latin America has had Asian levels of growth. If you can figure that out, then you can figure out a lot about what needs to be done. I will point out, and this is not it's an empirical fact. It's a troubling fact, but it's never empirically correct, that across Asia, in these major success stories, really only one country put in place effective reform policies while it was functioning in a democratic fashion. The others all put in place these reform agendas when they had relatively illiberal governments.
Phil, your organization wants to engage young people. It is engaging young people, and Mr. Gagawi gave us some examples of how they're doing that in their part of the world. Talk a little bit about why you think it's important to engage young people, and also what are some examples of some of the projects that you're most proud of in terms of Ashoka's work? Share some of those success stories with us.
This brings us back to how do we get to a world where everyone is a change maker? There's a big bottleneck. Only the children of the elite are given the opportunity when they're growing up to know that there are change makers, to actually master the very complicated social skills, not genetic skills, empathy, teamwork, leadership. The only way you master that is by practicing. And the only way that you know that you have those skills is by having done it. And the critical time is before 20. When we interview the entrepreneurs that we work with, you can almost always find that they started as a teenager. They had the experience that they had an idea. They built a team. They left something. Once that happens to someone, they are a change maker for life. So learning from the about 20% of the Ashoka Fellows who are focused on young people who do this over and over and over again, it is dramatic. Math and language scores shoot up. But much more important, young people know that they're powerful. Now, let me just ask you a really basic question. What is the key factor for success for any human grouping, a city, a company, a country? The half-life of the competitive advantages of technology or marketing is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. The one thing that really makes a difference is what proportion of the people in that community are change makers. Why did San Jose take off and St. Louis die? Why is Google able to challenge in market after market? Because they're trying to build very consciously a community of people where everyone is creative, everyone is a change maker. We know that that's what the future is about. Now, how do we actually make that happen? So we are working with the fellows across the world to build a civil rights, a women's movement for young people, so that not just the children of the elite, so all young people have the experience of being powerful, which means causing change, which is what the whole Clinton effort is about. What is giving? Giving is ultimately causing change. That's what makes everyone in this room happy. We're confident. We know we can learn anything. We can do anything. We have the gift of knowing we're change makers. It's almost hard to imagine what it's like not to have that gift. The cruelest thing you can do to anyone in a world where change is increasing, and this is literally true in a logarithmic rate, is to not give people the gift of being a change maker when they're a young person. If you have a 14-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 17-year-old, or you have a friend in that age range, and they're not being powerful now, you should be alarmed. You should be asking, what's wrong with the educational system? Why are we denying that opportunity to all but a few people? It's just unbelievably destructive and cruel. I'll give you one example of the difference this makes. One of the first youth ventures we had in this program is a young African-American boy from Cambridge, Massachusetts, actually, who was brought to our attention by the police department. He had a fascination with bicycles, other people's bicycles, which is something of a problem for the police. But they were very smart. They said, this guy really, he's got something. And so they suggested him to us. And he created something called Second Gear Bike. Some of you may have seen it on Mass Avenue between Cambridge and MIT. It's one storefront, then two. And his deal was any young person in the neighborhood could come, and if they worked and learned for 35 hours how to build and rebuild bicycles, they get a free bike. Now, how do you get the free bikes? Well, the Cambridge police, as you know, have lots of bikes because they recover them and they can't find the students. So they're dying with bicycles. So he didn't have a supply problem. Well, of course, many kids came through this program. It was very dramatic. You go there and we talked to him about this is not just a bike shop. This is an early step in this revolution of everyone a change maker. He got that. He was very capable and very eager to tell other people that that's what he was doing. Now, imagine, and he's now gone not to jail but to college and is a success. Now, imagine if we had 100,000 young Americans every year who had that experience. And our experience is that every Jason, you have 3 to 5 in the core group and maybe 20 doing the tutoring or running 3 hours of the virtual radio program a week or whatever it is. So you have a multiplier. If we have 100,000 young Americans starting their own idea, building their own organization, leaving something lasting, tutoring service, whatever, that means 2 million young Americans every year are having that experience. That means we can tip the culture in school after school. If you have 5 of these groups that succeed, that means 100, 150 kids, 5 peer groups selling to their peers. They can do it better than any of us can. You start creating cultures of competence and can versus can't. I would argue that we've got to do this all over the world. Your points in the Middle East are exactly right. Any country that falls behind in the proportion of its population or change makers is going to be a loser 10 years, 15 years from now, and the opposite is true. This is absolutely critical.
But you say that everyone is a change maker, but when you're cultivating role models and your fellows across the world, isn't it natural to want to sort of focus on the brightest and the biggest? So in that sense, isn't there a kind of a conflict of interest, sort of on the one hand saying that everyone can be a change maker, but a natural inclination is to want to kind of focus on a few of the best? So how do you marry those two conflicts?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because one of the things that just upsets me actually quite a bit is when people say, well, I don't believe that everyone can be a change maker. Now, when you look at adults that did not have that experience that we did when we grew up, of course they're not change makers. How do you suddenly become a change maker at 25? You haven't mastered these underlying skills. It's not your definition of yourself. You're in a pattern of relationships that's very different. You're stuck. That's exactly the point. These lives have been very severely limited. But when kids hit 12, they are totally ready for this. What they want to do more than anything else is figure out how to be really effective in human society. And we say to non-elite kids, no, we're in charge, adults are in charge of everything, the classroom, the workplace, if there's any extracurricular or sports left, we run those too, and you're not very responsible. Well, where have you heard this before? This is how we used to treat women, African-Americans, colonial people. This is incredibly destructive. This is the last large group of people we treat this way. And, it's exactly in those 0 to 3, you've got to get emotional health. This is the time you've got to learn these social skills and define it. Now, if anyone in this room was denied the power to be a change maker, just think, how naked would you feel? How out of control? where would the satisfaction we all get from being able to contribute, which is the most powerful way of giving and helping others? And to say that we are going to deny that to others is just wrong, absolutely wrong. It makes no sense if you think about the future of any society. It doesn't. It's absolutely cruel. It's the most destructive thing you can do to a human being is to deny them what is most important for us. And I don't think you have to be brilliant. You just have to believe and give yourself. And you know, once you know you have that ability, you have it. Jason's life is different. So Jason Upshaw, the guy I was just describing in Cambridge, all the kids he's working with, we can do this. And to not do it is just outrageous.
Okay, well, I think we have about 5 minutes left, so it's going to be a sort of a whiz around everybody just to sort of get your kind of closing thoughts on this session. Bob, do you think that there are enough change makers, as Bill is talking about them, in business and in government?
I think Bill's point is essentially right. Actually, Bill, businesses that have tried to empower their workers have had remarkable results, and I think your point is very well taken. I know of cases of businesses that have gone out broadly amongst their workforce, just regular run-of-the-mill workers, and have said, all right, what would you do in this situation, and have had tremendous results from it. So I think your point is basically right.
I wanted to just ask you, you're trying to launch a Grameen in the United States for immigrants who come over to the U.S. and don't have any kind of credit history. Why do you think that it's important to focus on that group of people?
Well, our focus always on the people who are rejected by the system. So these are the rejected people. So this is a natural area of attention. We do it in other countries, and it's a shame to see lots of pawn shops around in the United States. It's such a rich country with such a sophisticated banking system, financial system, but you have the pawn shops, you have the cash checking shops, all kinds of things that you don't like but still around. So we said this might be a possibility that we can bring another kind of banking system where these things can be addressed. And responding to some of the issues that have been raised, one about the young people, you asked the question. In Bangladesh, more than half the population of Bangladesh has 150 million people. More than half of them is under the age of 20. So basically, young people are the majority of the population. And one good thing about the young people is they're very quick in changing, adapting to the way the future is. So if you can concentrate on that, you build a new society very quickly, rather than concentrate or spread it out over the whole population. The world is changing very fast. But if you look from the older age groups to the younger age groups, it's the younger group which you pick up the changes very quickly and adapt it sounds to build it for the future. So from that point of view, I think concentration on the young people is very important. And if you want to build a society from the bottom, again, young people would be the one who will be getting ourselves out of it. And between the government and individuals, again, the same rule applies. Government is very slow to change in a fast-changing world. If the people, individuals, can contribute, can participate in addressing the issues, they can do much more innovatively, much more creatively than if you leave everything to the government to do it. So the government and individuals both at the same time doing it. And I think if you create environment in a way the individuals can perform, individual can participate, society will be changing faster than we can think of. So these are the two issues I thought I would mention.
Okay. I want to end with you, Mr. Gagawi. You are a member of the government. Is government slow to change? And leave us with some thoughts in terms of what experiences you'd like to share with our audience about the work that you've done in the foundation also.
We got a minute to go, basically, but I'll go to Mr. Rubin and my colleague here on the right.
I'll go to Mr. Rubin's point. I think governance is very essential, basically. I'll give you my own experience here and how can we transform the. We created a role model, basically, for our region where through empowerment, through efficiency, quality standard in the government that we worked at in the past 10 years. I started a project called mainly Excellence in the Government. We transform our economy, basically, in Dubai. Our growth rate is for the past 10 years been over 10%, which is the highest. Could you imagine if we have the whole Middle East, every single city, their growth rate over 10%? What's going to happen? What sort of society we're going to have? Other than that, basically, we transform our economy. Only 3% of our economy is out of oil and 30% out of tourism. So you flip the whole thing around, basically. 15 years ago, tourism, it wasn't even in the map. Today, it's 30% of our economy. We did it through.
You get more tourists than Egypt and India, I believe. People are going there, not seeing the Taj Mahal or the pyramids anymore.
But we made it out of nothing, actually. Probably you've been in Dubai a couple of years ago. I mean, we have only hot weather, we have sand, and we have sea. So what out of sand and sea, basically, you created a value, basically, for the country. This is the most important thing. But in a short span of time, there is an example that through empowering people, basically, what the government have done, they empower youth, basically, within the government also. They pull people like myself and some of my colleagues here, basically, and they give them the authority and let them really do the change process. Today, we can say probably that we are among the top 10 government efficient in the world. We are Middle Eastern, we are an Arab country again. Our e-government is one of the top 15 in the world. So there is a tremendous transformation that took place through enhancing the government, basically, in our country.
All right, I believe we're a little over time, but I'd like to thank all of you for joining us this morning and for sharing your wonderful stories with us. And thank you also to all of you for being here with us this morning. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. This session is now concluded.